This is Polling Matters in association with politicalbetting.com. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today I'll be talking to James Morris of GQR about Labour's polling during the last Parliament and the general election campaign. As most of you will know, James was Ed Miliband's private pollster. It's fair to say that Labour's defeat came as something of a shock to most Labour supporters and to many in the party too. I will be asking James whether it was a shock to him, the reasons for Labour's defeat, and what the differences between the private and public polls can tell us in light of the impending BPC inquiry into where the polls went wrong. We'll also be taking some questions from readers of politicalbetting.com. James, welcome to Polling Matters.
Thanks, Kieran.
Let's start at the beginning, because people know the concept of private polling, but perhaps they don't necessarily know what exactly it is you're doing. They're used to seeing that, you know, the YouGov poll in the Sun, whatever it might be. So we don't want to focus on this too much, but briefly, if you could just outline some of the polling you were doing for the party and maybe how frequent that was, sure. Different types of things you were doing.
Sure. So the Britain is lucky in that it has so much public polling, mainly tracking voting intention and tracking specific attitudes towards things. What private polling is normally designed to do is not to map what is going on, but to help parties understand what they need to do to win. So a bit of it is about measuring attitudes, but a lot of it is about testing messages, positioning, and in particular trying to understand the party brand. So a lot of newspaper polling quite sensibly asks people's attitudes to issues, like do you think cuts are too fast or too slow, whatever. Private polling will ask, what would you think about the Labour Party if they said that cuts should be faster or slower? And that interaction with the brand and the issue is quite different. So you'll get people nervous about Labour spending more who want the SNP to spend more, for example. And parties have to understand that. So it is a kind of different type of diagnostic polling that is much more rooted in the brand than in the issues, and then a set of message testing techniques to try and work out what would happen if you were to follow strategy A, strategy B, message A, message B. It is pioneered in Washington. So American elections, they spend more on TV ads in Orlando than the entire UK British election budget for all the parties combined for everything. And what that means is you have companies that are super specialised in politics in America. And so that has created an ecosystem of companies in Washington primarily who do polling for candidates in the US. Every other year, historically, they've had less work to do because elections in America are mainly every second year. So they then looked internationally to diversify what they're doing. And that led maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, to the push of American political polling out of the US to elections around the world. And now we poll in elections in every continent around the world, with a couple of other companies that do the same, using those techniques developed in Washington for political clients who want to try and understand how to win and can make the most of what is developed in that hothouse environment of Washington in countries that don't have that same industry.
But presumably you're still doing the so-called horse race, so you know, the voting intention question and some of the constituency level stuff as well. It's not just about the messaging,
right.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So you kind of want to understand where you are, and we'll talk about it, but it's the way you approach that might lead to different perception of where you are, of what the vote is. But if that was all you did, it wouldn't be that valuable. The real value is in working out what could work, what might make a difference.
So I'm interested in the chronology of the general election from your perspective, and I know a lot of listeners are interested in how that might have differed from what the public polling was saying. So let's go up to the short campaign for the start, and then we'll focus on the campaign in a moment. So let's roughly take it from maybe conference season through to the beginning of the short campaign. What was your polling showing that maybe the public polls were not? Yes.
So actually I think it's interesting looking at the whole Parliament, because the internal polls we were doing had the Conservative share roughly where the public polls had, but it had the Labour share consistently lower, sometimes 8 points lower, sometimes 3 or 4 points lower, and the gap between our polling and the public polling decreased as you move towards summer.
How often is your polling? Is that monthly as well, or is that...
At its most frequent monthly, okay. Earlier in the Parliament less, and later in the Parliament more. And the quantity of public polling means that you do need less private quant, if you trust it. So you load it towards the back end of the Parliament. You get right at the beginning a lot, and then at the end of the Parliament a lot, and less in the middle.
And these typically the 2,000 national samples again?
Yeah, it's that... It varies. So quite a lot of what we do is involve split sample tests, where you will give half a sample you'll model one message strategy. So you might model, they might see Tory attacks on Labour for being profligate and Labour messages saying, we've changed, we spent too much, we'll be more efficient, we'll crack down on waste. Or the other half of sample might see Labour messaging that is, actually, we did the right thing when the financial crash happened, the NHS was invested in thanks to Labour, spending is vital for our future, for example, two totally different strategies. And so when you're doing, and then you see at the end of that what has happened to the vote and views about the Labour Party. So if you're doing that kind of survey, you need a much bigger survey because you've got to split the sample. But if you're doing a more normal kind of message testing, tracking survey, 2000 national, it's quite...
Yeah,
similar sample structure to what you would get in a poll in a Sunday newspaper.
Because a lot's made of this this fabled crossover. And we all sort of, many thought it was coming. It didn't seem to come. Yeah. And people were mocking Linton Crosby. Oh, where's this crossover coming, Linton? So my understanding is that you, as you kind of alluded to already, and have spoken about in other sort of broadcasts, saw this a lot earlier than the public poll.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, so what happened straight after the Labour... So you remember the Labour conference was the conference where Ed's speech, he didn't mention the deficit, didn't mention immigration, various other issues with it. And we saw that the poll, the voting intention immediately turned to a tie, and then within a couple of weeks after that, the Tories went ahead and then stayed ahead through the last national poll we did, which was in March. So it crossed over... last year, I think Comrades had them crossover in January, and then most of the other polls didn't have crossover.
So Labour were never ahead between that conference speech and your polling until the short campaign? Or
So there were no national polls in the short campaign,
right.
But after that conference speech, Labour were never again ahead.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, let's talk about the short campaign then. I guess... Let's take the approach we've already taken. So what sort of polling are you doing during the short campaign? So you sort of alluded to there, you're not actually doing this national poll.
Right. So the issue, you know, particularly for the Labour Party, but for all parties, is to try and make sure they spend their money as efficiently as possible. So the working assumption was we have this huge amount of national tracking going on, courtesy of newspapers and others commissioning polls. We want to spend as little on polling as possible. We want to, because you don't win any votes with a poll.
Yeah.
So you want to have as much money going out into the field and out into places where it can be seen and deliver something. So the focus was entirely on seats that were not held by Labour that Labour wanted to win. So there was a battleground of around 70, 80 seats that were target seats. And the polls were just in those seats, tracking what was happening and also testing messaging a bit. However, as you get so close to the election, you do much less message testing. So you've got much less room to manoeuvre. So you might test a particular rebuttal, or you might be testing very specific tactical things, but the tram lines are set pretty much. So it's the polls become much more like trackers and much less like big strategic decision-making message testing polls.
So national polling-wise, just so I've got this clear in my head, national polling wise, there's nothing in the short campaign, and everything that you were producing between conference time or whenever after that crossover until you stopped doing that had the Tories ahead. So
or a tie, yeah.
Or a tie. So as far as Labour are concerned, or the sort of Labour leadership is concerned, that nationally they're going into the general election campaign either tied or behind.
Yeah, although you've got to you that's right. But at the same time, what a campaign does is look at one set of polls, like the internal polls, show one story. The polls that they're seeing every day show a different story.
YouGov or Comrades.
You then look at the Ashcroft polls in marginal seats, and they tell a story consistent with the newspaper national polls, not consistent with our marginal seat polls. So you rightly kind of think, well, what exactly here should I trust? Which bit of this is right? It would be wrong to say the party sort of knew that this was the position and they were wrong. Mm. That would actually have been an irrational way to react to all this information.
So your polling is essentially one data set out of many, and not just polling, actually. They've got canvas returns, and later on postal votes, and that sort of thing is coming through. So you're just one part of that.
Yeah, exactly. So you're like a privileged part of it, but you're not the... But it would be irrational to ignore all the information that's out there. Mm. It turned out that a lot of the information out there was misleading. Not by a lot, but by enough.
So you talked earlier about the focus of any polling you are doing during the short campaign is around constituency level stuff. So right. Does that mean you're polling individual seats, right, yeah. or does that mean you're doing like a sort of suite of six seats?
Yeah, it's a suite. So what the Liberal Democrats did was they had a much smaller list of target seats, and they probably spent more money as well, and they did individual seat level polls. That wasn't what we did. So what we did was create a battleground, which is the set of seats that we are trying to win, and treat that as the universe, and then poll representative of that universe.
Okay. And then, so, I mean, thinking about the different sort of suites of polling you did during the general election campaign, was there a sense of the race moving away from Labour and what you were doing, or did you find it broadly consistent? Because a lot of the constituency level polling seemed to suggest there was, either Labour were doing better at the marginals, yep. in some cases, than nationally, or at least that, the Conservatives being the biggest party was extremely unlikely. What were you seeing?
Right, so I think, split that into two bits, because whether or not the Conservatives are the biggest party, you couldn't tell directly from this set of polls, because we weren't polling in the southwest, which is where the Conservatives made their gains.
So this was Labour Conservative?
Yeah, exactly. There were some that were Lib Dem held, a couple, but it was mainly Labour Conservative marginal. So
this is interesting, actually, just to be clear. So you're not actually polling, and logically so in many respects, but you're not actually polling those Lib Dem Conservative marginals. So you are kind of, in a way, blind as to what's going
right.
to happen there.
That's right. And actually, there was a Comres poll of those seats that got almost no coverage, which showed the result. As in, what it predicted was a whitewash, and you got a whitewash. But it got very little coverage. Actually, we didn't pay enough attention to it. And so our working assumption was rooted in what we'd heard out of the Liberal Democrat camp from their polls, which showed that they were going to hold on to a lot of those seats. And secondly, a working assumption that if the Liberal Democrats are collapsing so badly to Labour in urban seats, that must mean that they're holding up somewhere. They've traditionally been incredibly good at their ground game and keeping hold of these seats. It makes sense to think they would do better than they did. Well, that was wrong. They did very, very badly. So you couldn't tell from the polls what the actual seat distribution would be. You could only tell whether you're making progress or going backwards in the set of seats that we were targeting. Within those, it was pretty flat. Then it looks like it got better for us after 3 weeks of the campaign, and then got significantly worse over the next 2 weeks. And then the final poll is about 10 days from polling day. So you don't know what happens at the very end. And the final poll, which is the one where the numbers are in Patrick Wintour's article right at the bottom, has the Tories 1 point ahead in those marginal seats. So what that was a 1 point swing from the Conservatives to Labour in those seats, when Labour needed a 3.5 point swing in those seats. So that meant Labour only picking up a handful there. But we're not polling in the defensive seats. We're not polling in seats Labour holds that the Tories are trying to win. So we don't know from polling, although I don't know what the canvas return showed, about the Tories' prospects of offsetting Labour gains from them with offsetting Labour gains from the Tories with Tory gains from Labour.
So that sounds to me, as a consultant, you're there sort of looking at the messaging and splitting these samples to see, okay, what's the way we should go on this issue or that issue. But actually, it's virtually impossible for you, at least with your own data, to say this is what the result's going to be.
Right. I mean, exactly.
You could go to Miliband and say, I think it's going to be this based on the collection of data that I have, but actually based on your data alone.
Yeah, it's literally impossible because you're not polling all the full range of seats. That's right.
Let's take some questions from political betting readers. So, I mean, one of the things that comes up time and time again that people are interested in is this idea of how much is the internal polling sort of shaping the campaign. And, you get the cynics out there that let's talk about policy by focus group, don't they? And they say, politicians just have policies that the polls tell them to have, and the other people think are more kind, and so actually we've got this idea and we're going to message test it to see how best we can promote it. Give us some insight into kind of what sort of areas you were testing in the run-up to general election and maybe during it in terms of messaging, and what sort of things you were finding.
I mean, I think the issue with focus groups is that you've got to know what to listen to. So people want a lot of things, fairly, but they're also very, very sensible, so they know that you've got to be able to pay for them. They know that If you're promising two contradictory things, you're unlikely to deliver either. And so one of the challenges is to make sure that you are listening to the big stuff they're saying. So when they say, yeah, that sounds nice, but I don't trust you to deliver it, do you listen more to the thing that they said it was nice? Mm-hmm. Or are you reporting back, but they don't trust us to deliver it, and what are we going to do about it? What we found very early on was that people saw cuts and control of public spending not solely through the lens of the need to reduce the deficit, but as something that was just, they just thought there was plenty of space in public spending to make savings. So you have GP receptionists saying, I've got three managers, or right. People saying, well, they're getting, you know, I know someone works in the public sector, gets a taxi from Norwich to Ipswich. They shouldn't get a taxi. So one of the things that kind of ran through the parliament and persists is a broad view that there's plenty of room to save money in public spending, that you should do whether or not you want to reduce the level of public spending. At the same time, there is deep distrust of Labour as a steward of public money. So even if they want more investment, Scotland's the best example. Right? In Scotland, people were anti-austerity, they wanted to increase public spending, but they just didn't trust Labour to be the people who would spend more, because just as in England, Scots doubt Labour's ability to manage public finances carefully. The challenge late on in the Parliament was that because Labour hadn't addressed those things early in the Parliament, things that were said that were designed to address them were taken with a huge pinch of salt. So, for example, the manifesto launched on a fiscal reassurance platform, first page.
On the front page, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of helped a bit, but it would have helped a lot more if it had been 4.5 years earlier.
I mean, Scotland's one of the interesting issues, isn't it? Because there was this kind of SNP surge, and, at what point did your polling show, I mean, to the extent that maybe you even polled Scotland, I'm not sure, but at what point did your polling show that the SNP threat was a big deal, something that was potentially terminal to Labour's chances, not just in Scotland itself, but actually within those English margins?
So I remember, there was a poll we did in Scotland last year, which had these, you know, catastrophic numbers, the SNP on 47, Labour close to the Tories and so on. And it's an example of where you have a set of numbers and people are, you know, squinting at them, unsure whether that can be right. And then another poll came out a day later, very similar numbers and so on. And so I think, and people would report that back from their constituency. And so all the different data points made people in Scotland believe that what appeared to be the case was in fact the case. Mm-hmm. In England, I think the Tories did the first 3 weeks of the Tory campaign were zigging and zagging all over the place, finding stuff to say. They fastened on this issue, and when they fastened on it, it wasn't the biggest issue in the world, and they did a fantastic job of driving it up the agenda. So it's actually a very good example of how to use a focus group well. Because they know Labour isn't trusted with money. They know that people think that... You know, Boris's quote was, truckfuls of dosh being driven up the M1 to Scotland. They know that English people think that happens. And Scots, by the way, think the opposite happens. And they put those together, put a message together, and were willing to commit to that message and drive it up. So the more they stayed on it, the more its salience went up. And the worrying thing in focus groups when we were looking at it was... early on, maybe only two or three people had heard that thing, but once they mentioned it, the other five people all started getting concerned and off put by it. So the qual was a better read on that than the quant, because the qual showed you where the message was heading and how much grip it potentially could have, and that the reason why it wasn't scoring really high in quantitative polling was because the penetration wasn't high enough, rather than because it was just a dead message that wasn't going to resonate, as like their tax messages, for example, didn't really resonate.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm interested in the kind of the specific kind of seat-by-seat strategy that Labour might have adopted during the campaign. You talked about doing sweeps of marginal constituencies, but am I right in thinking that you weren't necessarily doing individual sort of constituencies?
Right.
Because people ask about Ed Balls, don't they? And there's all these rumours about the Miliband campaign has data on Ed Balls that they're not sharing, but... presumably your case there, your position there is that we didn't produce individual constituents.
Yeah, I mean that specific rumour is sort of, yeah, we didn't produce, there were no seat specific polls. There were no polls in seats that Labour held, and Eccles lost by 460 votes. So the idea that anyone could have known that would happen is ridiculous. On the other hand, better intelligence in that seat of what was going on would have led to more. You know, Jim Murphy yesterday giving his speech at Policy Exchange, and he was saying how incredibly helpful Eccles had been, how often he would come up to Scotland, and maybe if he hadn't been up in Scotland so much, you know, so there are a million. You know, it's a real shame for the Labour Party that he lost. A real shame, and he was fantastic in the campaign.
Mm.
But the idea anyone knew that was happening, you know, no. Should they have known? That's a more interesting question.
So I guess one of the key things people want to know, given all the press that's been out there, and I can kind of see where you might end up going with this, is that there's all these rumours about, Ed Miliband's sitting there, you know, on the night of the election, exit poll comes out even, and he's writing his victory speech, which one columnist has mentioned. So people kind of find that hard to believe. Did Ed Miliband genuinely believe he was going to win? I mean, I know you wouldn't have been with him on that night, knowing whether or not he was actually writing that speech, but was your sense that the leadership felt they were going to win?
Well, if you look at, yes. And the reason is...
By when, of course, I mean former government.
Former government. And the reason for that is that, you know, if you assume the SNP would have stuck with what they said, then the distribution of seats in Scotland wouldn't actually make a difference to whether the Tories can pass a Queen's speech. They would make a difference to how strong Labour's parliamentary representation was. But either way, they were votes against the Tory Queen's speech. If you thought, which we did, and it was wrong, that the Lib Dems were going to hold on to a big chunk of their seats against the Tories, then you only needed very modest gains to be able to form a government. Now, it's not the goal, but it means that structurally it was easier to get to a position where there was a majority against a Cameron Queen's speech, and the battle would be, how do you make sure you get that vote put to the House of Commons quickly, or make sure he steps down and so on. So there's another faulty assumption I'll come to in a second, but for all those reasons, there was very strong belief that one way or another it would be at worst a very unclear result, and in fact it was a very clear result. The assumption that was wrong but was sort of more, you know, I think some of those errors are kind of understandable. The one that's more fundamental is about UKIP, and you know, if you look at the change in seats, where UKIP did better, Labour did worse, basically had more trouble winning seats, and where UKIP did less well, Labour...
It feels like Conservatives were better at squeezing their UKIP voters than Labour were necessarily at theirs.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right, and I think the SNP risk message in England was a big part of it. You know, right at the start of the Parliament, there were two issues that were big problems for Labour. One was spending, and the other was immigration. And on immigration, Labour's actually got a set of positions now. It's not prejudiced, it's a legitimate issue, benefits cap, it's a whole range of things. They're all sort of quite economic. There's a little bit of public service and not a lot of cultural stuff in there, but there's a set of things that are quite good positions for those voters. But those voters didn't know about them, or if they did know about them, didn't believe them. Because again, if you don't do the work at the start of the Parliament, it's going to be very hard to make these things credible at the end of a Parliament.
Mm.
And so that's important, I think, for the next leader, that in some way, you know, in some ways, what they do with their first 2 weeks is going to be worth... If they don't get those first 2 weeks right, it may not be possible to get to win whatever they do with their last 2 years. Because who the public come to see you as, and what they think your direction is, and whether they believe you made changes, particularly on spending and immigration, are going to determine whether they believe you as authentic and credible when you come and say other stuff later on.
Mm.
If you're still trying to do that work near the end, it's pretty much undoable.
So it sounds like it's about nailing your colours to your mast early, essentially, whoever that leader might be.
Yeah.
Let's explore Labour's sort of future in more detail now. I guess why Labour lost and where it goes from here are almost inextricably linked,
yeah,
in terms of you know, the lessons you learn from the election influences the direction in which you take the party. What's your sense of the key reasons why Labour lost? I mean, briefly, I guess, and then Where do you think it needs, what direction do you think it needs to be going in the future? A couple of specific points. There is a debate in the party about, well, there seems to be a debate in some areas of the party about, are we targeting Conservative votes or not? Yeah. Or is it about this progressive alliance of Greens and winning back in Scotland and those sorts of things? You know, is it about the leader as much as policies? I mean, what's your take on that?
So I think on the first one of those, I think it's really obvious that you've got to win votes back from the Conservative Party. To think of those people as Conservative voters is like thinking of working class older men as Labour voters. It turns out they're UKIP voters. So these are just people. A lot of them work in the private sector, don't rely on the state as much as people on lower incomes do or people who work in the public sector do. So there's less, you know, they ask for less, they need low mortgage rates, they need a steady economy, they need their companies to grow. You've got to win those people. They voted Conservative last time. There's a better way of thinking about it, though, which is not to sort of go through different groups of the population and say we need to get 4% here and 3% there and let's add two of those and one of them, but instead to think, start the thinking with the brand. And what is the brand's strength? It is seen as, relatively speaking, on the side of ordinary people, although it's lost some of that, and the party, the NHS. What's its weakness? It's seen as financially profligate, fiscally profligate, spends money on anything, got its priorities wrong, content with waste, can't manage an economy, and it is liable to prioritise non-British people over British people, which is not really a point about race. It's a point about immigration coming here from Eastern Europe. It's a point about the way it works with America. It's very, so if those are your brand weaknesses, then to be trusted to do more, you have to cauterise those weaknesses. That is not enough, because we're not bad is unlikely to be a winning pitch. So you've got to then have something positive to say that's strong. That has got to be much more of a view about how the country prospers and succeeds and families get on and so on than people heard over the last 5 years. On spending specifically, it is not about litigating the past. My view is that it's got to show that it's changed from the past. It recognises there were mistakes. Right? That executive pay, top pay in the public sector under Labour was higher than it needed to be. IT systems, you can list ways. But it's got to show it's got a different approach to spending in the future. So fiscal rules might be a bit of it, but there's stuff about efficiency, about making public services work more effectively, that just show that in your guts you really hate wasting money. Mm. So deal with those two problems and then have something more positive to say. The interesting challenge is that some people would argue the way to make that case for the future is to make an argument for investment. Making an argument for investment is an argument for borrowing. You couldn't do that unless you're trusted to spend money. You're not trusted to spend money at the moment. So you've got to, at the very least, do them in order rather than try and sort of come out with a big bang answer. Final thing I'll say, I'm going on your answer to this question, but more people thought the Conservative Party were radical at the last election than the Labour Party. But by 70 to 20, roughly, people prefer sensible, concrete change to radical, big vision. So you've got the idea that there is some sort of inspirational radical vision out there is wrong. And also the idea that people were alienated by Labour's radical big vision is also wrong. It's just a like irrelevant issue, pretty much. You've got to show people you can make practical differences and you can be trusted.
And there's a big identity question as well, which you know, I wouldn't necessarily say runs in conflict, but it's certainly a difficult challenge to navigate, where we've got this issue, and how do you win in England and Wales, but also Scotland too? And one of the questions we've got from the website is, you know, would Labour poll better if it just focused specifically on policies that concentrated on England and Wales and almost treated Scotland like it was a separate province? Obviously, Labour would never say that. But there is this difficult challenge, isn't there, of winning back voters in Scotland and England at the same time, who maybe want different things.
Yeah, I think the extent to which they want different things is overemphasised. So it's an example of where understanding the brand takes you to a different position to understanding the issue. It's certainly true that English and Scottish voters have different views about austerity and cuts. Scottish, much more sceptical of them. But if you ask them about how much they trust Labour to spend public money, their views are really similar. They don't. So the kinds of moves that are similarly on immigration, England, Scottish people are somewhat more liberal on immigration than English people, but neither of them trust Labour to control the borders, and they want to trust Labour to control the borders. So the kinds of moves necessary to rehabilitate Labour in England are also helpful in Scotland. there isn't that big tension that some people think might exist. There is an issue about identity and about arguing for your country. Englishness is really important to people, and people feel English. They don't feel West Midlands-ish, or, you know, these kind of local devolution ideas might be very good technically, but they're not any use as answers to the question of patriotism. So Labour has to stand up for being English and have a view about what Englishness means. It has to stand up for being Scottish and have a view about what being Scottish means, and it needs to have a structure that allows it to do both, which might mean more separate parties in England and Scotland that allow them to advocate for their own country more forcefully. It also just needs to people need to feel it. So they need to feel that the Labour your average Labour politician will be perfectly happy with flag of St George outside their house. They don't find that weird. Now, that is not entirely true of it's certainly not the way people perceive the Labour Party at the moment. So it's got to be part of the emotional identity of the party.
Mm. One final question on Labour before we talk briefly about the BBC inquiry. I mean, I won't put you on the spot and say which candidate you're backing or anything like that, but from your work with the Labour Party in the last few years, do you get a sense of any one of the candidates for leader that maybe has the best chance of winning the membership vote, given all the challenges that they face and some of the things they've been saying?
I have no idea about the membership vote. I do think that they all are. They all have real strengths, and they're all kind of developing a set of ideas that aren't out there yet. The strongest candidate will be a credible Prime Minister who is willing to show clear change on those two issues I banged on about, which is essentially immigration and spending, and who has something positive to say about how the country can succeed. They're all sort of in that space. You've got to listen to more of what they say. Those criteria are probably not the same criteria that a lot of people in constituency Labour parties will apply. And so they've got to try and navigate the party internal politics. But when it comes to the country, that seems to me what they've got to be able to do, and got to be able to do it straight away.
Sure. I mean, let's talk about the BPC inquiry. Obviously, I think it's fair to say that when private pollsters say, we had this private data that showed that things broadly right, sorry guys, you got it wrong publicly, there's a healthy dose of scepticism in terms of that. I'm interested in just getting your views on that inquiry and in terms of what sorts of things they should be looking at, and also the question I keep getting asked when I said I was going to talk to you is, are you planning on releasing any data that that you've had in the background?
I'd like to, as much as possible, it'd be great. The final marginal poll, because the numbers have appeared in The Guardian, it's not a problem to put those tables online, we can do that later today or tomorrow, and the more the better.
So when was that conducted? That was the week before, was it?
Yeah. In terms of the inquiry, I think that the specific thing, first of all, I think it's going to be done in good faith, and usually it's going to take a long time, it seems, but it's a very good thing to do. It's limited by the information that pollsters actually have on the people who took part in the poll. So trying to spot sample imbalances, you can only spot them with reference to the questions that were actually asked. So that might be a challenge. But the specific thing that I think would be useful to look at is question order. What we do is ask people about their top issues, what they think of the leaders, what they think of the parties, what they think of the direction of the economy, and their living standards before the voting intention question. Interestingly, that is what the British Election Study did as well. Slightly different list of questions, but they asked some questions before the voting intention question. If you look at their data done on the YouGov panel, it has a different result consistently through the campaign to what YouGov got from the YouGov panel, with a lower Labour share and a higher Conservative share, which is the same as we have. Mm. I think that is because people are getting into a ballot box mindset before they get to the voting intention question, rather than someone just phoning them up and just asking them a random question, or them turning up online and it's the first question they ask. So I think that is a thing to look at. The BES, I think, randomised the position of that question at some points in the development of the survey, so they can look to see whether it made a difference.
Because one of the things that some of the pollsters are looking at is, are they getting an accurate reflection of voters?
Yeah.
People are actually going to turn up. And we always know that public polls, at least, will show turnout much higher than yep. what actually ends up being. Are you doing anything on that that's specifically different to what the public pollsters are doing? Or is it really all about question and order for you?
No, well, I think there are two things. One is I think we have a perfectly unremarkable turnout filter similar to what other people would use. So I don't think it's our turnout filter makes a difference. I think, though, that there is the questionnaires we field are longer and more political and kind of more engaged. They're wordier than a typical newspaper poll. And I wouldn't be surprised if that leads to drop-off of people who are not likely voters, which we're totally relaxed about. So I think there may be a kind of selection that's happening through the structure of the questionnaire that means the kinds of people who aren't going to vote aren't going to do the questionnaire.
Are you always online, or is it just...
Almost always. Mm-hmm. At one point, we did a telephone poll, like within the last year, to sort of validate the online with a really thorough telephone poll, very high mobile sample, and got the same result within a point. So that's what makes me think it is not the sampling. I think also the British Election Study getting such different results with literally the same panel, where the only difference between what they did, well, one of the main differences is question order. Again, makes me think that it's there's definitely something in that. It's probably not the whole thing, and it's probably different if you don't have such a long questionnaire. Again, the British Election Study is a long, very political questionnaire. You actually look at what their Sunday Times polls are like compared to their weekday polls, because Sunday Times polls were really long and very political. So if I'm right about drop-off, they might actually be producing different results systematically to the weekdays, and find that out.
And presumably, without answering the question for you, in terms of actually releasing all the historic data, that's not your hands are presumably tied somewhat, in the sense that that's client data, isn't it? So you can't just go, right, here you go, here's the last years of voting.
The Labour Party is really keen to have, you know, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is the way Harriet described it. So,
but not just from a Labour perspective, but I mean from the inquiry perspective, in terms of, okay, our poll will show you different things to the public polls.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's our data. Do you think is that likely to happen? Do you think, or?
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, because it's informally, obviously, we talked to some of the people involved there, and I just can't see any particular reason why it's a problem. But I can't just make that decision.
Yeah. That was Polling Matters in association with politicalbetting.com. Very many thanks to James Morris for taking the time to speak to me. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under a Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.